Please be seated. Before we start on our first case of the day, you will note that the chair generally occupied by Justice Abrahamson is empty today. She is online and will be talking to us by phone. So if you hear a voice from the ceiling, it's just Justice Abrahamson wanting to ask a question. With that little bit of announcement in place, I call our first case State versus, is it Langlois? Is it?
Langlois.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Andrew Jarmus, and I am appearing here today on behalf of the petitioner in this case.
Counsel, would you do me a favor and speak up, please?
I can certainly do that. Is that better?
Yeah. Moving the mic is a great help. Thank you. That's much better.
Thank you. As I said, my name is Andrew Jarmus, and I am representing the petitioner in this case, Joseph Langlois. This case involves unobjected to erroneous jury instructions that corrupted the integrity of the fact-finding process. The breakdown really began in this case when the state, after resting its case, decided it had not likely proven its case. And that was on the charge of first-degree reckless homicide. It requested the court give additional instructions on lesser-included offenses, second-degree reckless homicide, and homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon. Essentially, everyone then had to scramble over the next evening into the next day to come up with the correct jury instructions. But unfortunately, the court, the defense attorney, and the prosecution failed to come up with those correct jury instructions. Therefore, the jury was not able to come to the correct conclusion, in this case, that Mr. Langlois was not guilty of the charge of homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon. The problem was that these charges were treated differently when it came to the defenses of self-defense and accident. The trial court did not give one complete proper instruction on self-defense or one complete proper instruction on accident. It decided to treat them differently.
Counsel, was the first instruction on self-defense, was that done correctly?
Yes.
Okay. And so your concern is the second time the self-defense instruction was given?
That's correct, Your Honor. Right.
Would you agree that we do not look at instructions in isolation, but that we look at them as a whole?
Yes, the jury instructions are considered as a whole. That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So if there is a defect in, if there's a defect in one of the instructions, could that be remedied by the other instructions surrounding it?
It could, but I don't think we have that in this case here.
Right. So tell me why the first correct self-defense instruction was not a sufficient remedy for the omission of the state's burden of proof the second time the instruction was given.
Specifically regarding self-defense?
Yes.
Or both? Okay. The jury was instructed to consider the charges and not consider the next charge until they had decided the first, such as first-degree reckless homicide. So even though there was a correct instruction regarding self-defense for that charge, later on the jury was given a separate instruction. The jury was not instructed that self-defense applies the same way for all these charges.
Hang on just a second on that. The first time the instruction was given, the court said that instruction applied to all three levels, correct?
As far as I believe it had statements relating to reckless as well as criminally negligent conduct. That was my recollection of the first instruction.
And that covers negligent homicide by negligent handling of a deadly weapon? Yes?
If you're saying that a reference to criminally negligent,
yes.
I guess overall it would relate to that. Yes.
Is there anything else that criminally negligent conduct could refer to in this case?
not based on those charges. I think the distinction that I'm talking about here is that the court could have said, we're going to apply this to all the charges, but it instead decided to restate self-defense. And so the jury was in a position where it had to consider the homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon, and the jury did not know at that point how to consider that properly. They did not know that the state had the burden on that specific charge. It's our position that a passing reference for the first-degree reckless charge did not fully inform the jury and allow them to make the proper conclusions regarding self-defense on that homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon.
Counsel, I had some concerns as I read the briefing and parts of the record that perhaps there was an error made in proceeding on both self-defense and accident. In regard to the self-defense, he could have walked out of the room. As I read the record, I was a little surprised you got that instruction for Mr. Langos. Did you have any concerns about the fact that perhaps counsel should have chosen to proceed on one theory, not two, in defense?
Your Honor, there are potential concerns that it may be some sort of mixed situation where Mr. Langlois was at first defending himself and that what ultimately happened turned into an accident, if that makes sense.
Well, I understand that was sort of the theory that was put forth, but since he could always leave the room, I had a lot of trouble with the self-defense being a valid defense under the facts of this case, to be quite frank. And I know you're concerned about the jury instructions, but if it wasn't a valid defense, it doesn't much matter what the jury instructions were.
Well, Your Honor, it was certainly a valid defense. Self-defense was what Mr. Langlois was asserting at that time.
I understand that's what was asserted. My question was more to the line of maybe he should have just asserted accident and might have had a better result with the jury.
You know, that's something that was ultimately a issue to be decided by trial counsel as far as how they wanted to approach the situation. You know, obviously, Mr. Langlois did not have a duty to retreat in his own home. He was trying to reclaim property that he believed had been taken by his brother.
So you don't have a problem with both of those defenses being in the same case, correct?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, that's fine.
Counsel, do you have a problem with what Judge Riley from the Court of Appeals said in his dissent, reading from paragraph 56? The court could have given one complete proper instruction on self-defense and told the jury that it applied to all three crimes, but it did not do so. Do you agree with that? Not that it did not do so, but that the court could have given one complete instruction on self-defense and told the jury that it applied to all three crimes?
Yes, I believe that would have been the case, or could have been the case.
I have a problem, and give me your best argument then, because if you agree with that, we don't see that much of a difference between saying, here's I'm instructing you on first and second degree reckless homicide and instructing you on negligent handling of a dangerous weapon. And then as to all three, here's the self-defense. That's the scenario I just pointed out in paragraph 56 of the dissent in the Court of Appeals. So what's the difference between that scenario and the judge instructing on first and second degree reckless homicide, giving the complete self-defense instruction, instructing on the negligent handling, and then saying, and then doing a reference back? Why is that so different than the first scenario, such that it would require a reversal in this case?
Well, in this case, you know, Let me know if I'm not answering your question. I'm trying to answer it. But the way I see it in this case is that the court chose to re-instruct on self-defense for that homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon charge. And when it did so, it did not give the state's burden on that charge. And so the jury, by implication, had the conclusion that the state did not have the burden of disproving self-defense in this case. So that's what I see it coming down to.
Even though it referenced back, what were the words, the exact words chosen by the court in referencing back?
Your Honor,
if not exact, give me ballpark.
As far as on self-defense?
Yes.
I think the only references that I recall back to it was maybe as I previously stated or something
yes.
along those lines.
That's correct.
So why was that not sufficient to reincorporate the first instruction?
The issue is that as I previously stated, but then it didn't state everything that I previously stated.
Okay,
it just laid out part of it.
Yeah.
And so it made a distinction between how to treat those charges. And the jury was not in a position to know or understand since they had not been instructed in that way.
Well, the point of referring back is so that you don't have to restate everything that you already said, right?
Well, I think in this case it was necessary given that essentially everything was restated except the important part dealing with self-defense and who had the burden.
All right. So let's take a look at that piece in particular. So the concern is the statement of the burden of proof, a subject that permeated the instructions to the point, I think, potentially of complete saturation. So starting on page 12 of the instructions given to the jury, there is the instruction on the substantive crime, homicide by negligent handling of weapons. And the instruction says the state has the burden beyond reasonable doubt. Then there's the accident instruction on page 13. It says the state has the burden beyond reasonable doubt. Then there's a state an instruction about the jury's decision. It says on page 13 that the state has a burden beyond the reasonable doubt. Then there's instruction 112. Not entirely sure what instruction 112 is meant to address, but it says the state has the burden on all of its elements beyond reasonable doubt. Then there's an instruction on presumption of innocence on page 14, and it says the state has the burden beyond reasonable doubt. Then there's the instruction on the state's burden of proof, and it says the state has the burden of proof beyond reasonable doubt on page 15. And then on page 16, there's an instruction on circumstantial evidence in which the jury is told that the state bears the burden proof beyond reasonable doubt. It says it so many times. How could the jury possibly think that the state doesn't bear the burden of proof beyond reasonable doubt?
Well, Your Honor, you have indicated that it does say it several times, but not on this charge regarding self-defense.
Right.
So by omission, by leaving it out and saying it so many times in other places, the court is telling the jury it doesn't apply in this case.
All right. And if the court had never said anything about self-defense and the burden of proof, that would have some traction, I think. But if the court says, as I previously said, and a conscientious juror goes back to what he previously said, he would learn that even there, the state bears the burden beyond reasonable doubt, wouldn't he?
Your Honor, I don't think the jury was in a position to go back to the previous charge. The jury was told to consider the first. He couldn't come up if he found him not guilty there. Then you would go to the next charge.
Right.
If not there, then you would go to the next charge.
Right.
And
but
so,
if the court invites the jury to go back to a prior instruction, which is what it did when it said, as I previously stated, why would the jury not understand that that's an invitation to go back to that original instruction?
Your Honor, I guess I see that as a transition phrase rather than actually referring them back to the self-defense.
The transition phrase would be something more akin, and now we move on to self-defense. As I previously stated, serves both as a transition and a reference back, doesn't it?
Well, I think it causes confusion because it doesn't specifically tell them to go back to that, but it then tries to lay it out and lays it out differently than on that charge.
Counsel, did the jury instructions go in with the jury? Did they deliberation?
I believe the instructions did go with them. I don't have any reason to believe otherwise.
I'm sorry, did or did not?
I believe they did.
And the instructions themselves said that the instructions would go back to the jury, correct?
I believe so.
Yeah.
We're talking about self-defense, and if you'd move on to accident.
Yes.
At this.
Yes. Yes. Your Honor, on accident, we dealt with the instructions not setting forth the proper mental state for the charge of homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon. The language that was in the jury instructions was dealing about not being aware of the risk of death or great bodily harm required for a crime, and then later should have been aware of the risk of death or great bodily harm. And that's not what the standard is. The standard should have been referring back to criminal negligence, which had been set out properly in the instructions, or alternatively setting out the proper standard, being that Mr. Langlois was not aware of the unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm required for a crime. And similarly, later in the instruction, before you find the defendant guilty, the state must prove by evidence that satisfies you beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant should have been aware of the unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm. And by not having that unreasonable and substantial language, or specifically referencing back to criminal negligence, which has that information, the jury was not properly instructed on accident.
Well, let's say that a very conscientious juror looked at that instruction and said, well, it doesn't say unreasonable and substantial when referring to the accident instruction, and so I guess, you know, he's not entitled to the defense of accident, right?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that last part. I apologize.
So he's not entitled to the defense of accident because they say, you know, it doesn't say unreasonable and substantial. And he was aware of something that was less than unreasonable or substantial. And so he doesn't get the accident defense, right? So let's assume
Correct.
That. So now they have to go to the substantive offense and say, well, does he meet all of those elements? Yeah? That's what they need to do?
Correct.
Okay. And in that, they go through that line of instructions that fully defines the substantive offense, including criminal negligence, and there they run into the unreasonable and substantial language, and they say, oh, well, I can't convict him unless he knew that he created a risk of death or an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm, right?
Yes.
Okay. So so if they believe that he did not know that there was that he had created an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm, they couldn't convict him just by virtue of the instructions on the substantive offense, correct?
Relating to the substantive offense, I think yeah. I think so. I think you're correct on
okay. that. So why does it matter that they would not be able to convict him under the substantive offense when there was an error in the accident instruction on the same element? You can't get a conviction. Let me just restate that. Under the substantive offense, he can't get convicted unless the unreasonable and substantial requirement is satisfied. So why does it matter that it has to be that the element is not in the accident instruction when it is in the instruction for the substantive offense?
Well, I think in order for the jury to properly consider the accident defense, that language needs to be in there.
Sure. Let's say that's true. So what? This is just a logic puzzle, isn't it? So if the accident defense was defective, but the substantive offense instruction was correct, and the difference is the defect in the accident instruction was cured in the substantive offense instruction, he can't get convicted unless he created a risk of an unreasonable and substantial risk of great bodily harm, correct?
Yeah, I think it created, along with the other issues, created confusion for the jury as far as how they were to properly consider those offenses, or that offense in particular. So when we combine and consider both of these defenses of self-defense and accident, the concern here is that the real controversy was not tried as well. Mr. Langlois was in a position to defend himself, and what ultimately happened was a situation where he was defending himself, and then after being choked by his brother, after being kicked by his brother, he did pick up that knife to defend himself. And so when he was ultimately in that moment, his actions were not unreasonable. He was acting in self-defense. He did act properly under the circumstances. So we are asking that the court alternatively order a new trial in this case, or alternatively find that there was insufficient evidence to convict him on this charge.
Are you asking for a Mockner hearing?
That is something alternatively we have asked for the court. We feel that the record has been developed quite a bit, but we don't have some of that information from the attorney who was the trial attorney in this case. So alternatively, we have also asked for that. But given the posture of the case, given all the other evidence and information that's been presented, we feel that the court does have enough information to order a new trial in this case.
Can you clarify a couple of things for me?
Yes.
I just want to make sure that I'm on the same page with your arguments and how this went down at trial. If you win and get the primary relief you're seeking a new trial, right?
A new trial, yes. Yes.
And the new trial would be, initially he was charged with three counts?
Initially charged with one, but ultimately,
the trial was on
the three charges.
Three.
Yep.
And he was found not guilty of two of the three.
Correct.
So the sentence, which was withheld, probation given,
yes,
was for the negligence.
Homicide
count.
By negligent handling of a dangerous weapon. Correct.
Do you, at trial, was the defense accident as to the negligence count? Was it self-defense as to the negligence count, or was it sort of a combined effort? Because I can see how counsel would want to maybe, depending on which count, I mean, the other two carried more significant penalties, and the jury found him guilty of the negligence count, right?
Yes.
What were the defenses that lined up with the counts is what I'm getting at trial?
Well, I think they both apply. It was somewhat of a mixed approach, as you indicated. But it was not clearly one or the other. They were both essentially asserted.
So it wasn't, I mean, the mental state to be described in the accident instruction would have been negligence.
Criminal negligence, that's correct.
Okay, so the defendant did not act with criminal negligence. And then the self-defense instruction that you would ask be given with respect to the negligence count would be he acted in self-defense, so he wasn't guilty, nor was he negligent. You would still say both defenses apply to that third count? Because if we send it back, it's not a trial on all three. He was found not guilty of two of the three, so it would be a trial on one count.
Right.
So you're saying both defenses were argued regarding this one count?
Yes.
And the jury instruction regarding those defenses was fell short regarding that third count exactly how?
One, on self-defense. It did not properly lay out the state's burden, and there's a whole paragraph that was missing from the self-defense instruction on that charge. And as far as accident, it did not properly lay out accident, either referring back to the criminal negligence as far as the mental state that you were referring to, or alternatively saying that it was substantial and unreasonable. It did not include that language. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm at my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Donald LaRocca appears on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. The jury determined that Joseph Langlois negligently handled a dangerous weapon in a manner that caused his brother Jacob's death. He raises several claims, all based on instructional error. It's the State's position that, first, the instructions themselves did not misstate the substantive elements of the crime. Second, that the instructions squarely place the burden of each of those elements on the state to prove them beyond a reasonable doubt. Third, the court instructed the jury on both of Joseph's requested defenses, their negative defenses of self-defense and accident. And fourth, those instructions never shifted the burden to Joseph to prove that he acted in self-defense or that what happened was an accident. Nowhere in the instructions do we have a situation where the burden is pushed over onto Joseph to show he acted in self-defense. And that contrasts, for example, with the Schultz case, which is mentioned in the reply brief and which is referenced in the Austin case, in which it was an intoxication defense to a charge involving first-degree intentional homicide, and the theory was that the intoxication of the individual was such that it negated that individual's ability to form intent. And in Schultz, the problem with those instructions is that the judge repeatedly said, Mr. Schultz has to establish that his intoxication was a certain degree such that he could not form intent. We don't have that kind of language here. And because of the 4 points that I made, the instructions as a whole correctly stated the law. They properly placed the burden of proving Joseph's guilt on the state beyond a reasonable doubt. Joseph hasn't met his burden of proving that trial counsel was ineffective, that the instructions he hasn't proved that they unconstitutionally misled the jury, or that this is an extraordinary case requiring this court to exercise its discretionary authority and reverse in the interest of justice. With respect to the sufficiency claim, which is in part at least the way it's been argued by Joseph, that the evidence was not sufficient. Again, the state, I think the evidence in the record supports the jury's determination that Joseph handled the dangerous weapon, that his handling of the dangerous weapon caused his brother Jacob's death. The way he handled the weapon created an unreasonable and substantial risk of death and great bodily harm. And that while the jury determined that he was not necessarily aware of the risk by acquitting him of the reckless homicide charges, they found that he should have been aware of the risk by finding that he committed the crime of homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon.
Mr. LaDaraca, let's start with the self-defense instruction. So properly instructed the first time, second time it omitted the state's burden of proof with respect to self-defense. Why shouldn't we find that a reasonable juror could look at the two instructions and say, well, I guess it's different when we're looking at negligent homicide. And otherwise, why would the court have instructed me twice and then had a substantive omission the second time?
In this case, when the judge led off with the instructions, he told the jury that when he read the instructions to them and he led off and he told them what they were going to be deciding, he told them about all three crimes, first-degree reckless, second-degree reckless, and then negligent handling. He then briefly introduced the concept of reckless homicide, first-degree reckless homicide, and then he proceeded to instruct on self-defense. And the court said self-defense is an issue in this case. The court did not limit it to self-defense as an issue with respect to first-degree reckless or second-degree reckless or negligent homicide. In fact, he went on to state that it applies to all three of the offenses that are involved here. In this case, the language that was omitted the second time around is the language that says if Joseph was acting in lawfully in self-defense, then his conduct did not create an unreasonable risk to another. And then there's the language about the state's burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act lawfully in self-defense. And then the important language from Instruction 801, you must be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt from all the evidence in this case that the risk was unreasonable. So that language was provided, and in conjunction with the first round of the self-defense instructions. And it's important that in a case like this, we're not talking about an affirmative defense. We're not talking about an offense. Self-defense, if this were an intent crime, self-defense would be it's considered an affirmative defense. But here, it's a negative defense. And what it is, the risk that's referred to in both the self-defense instruction and the accident instruction is the same whether we're talking about reckless behavior or negligent behavior. That is, a defendant's conduct created an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm.
Then why not have just one instruction on self-defense and one instruction on accident for all three crimes? Don't you think it could have been a little confusing for the jury to see more than one instruction on self-defense and more than one on accident, and then perhaps notice that there's different language in each instruction, but somehow they're supposed to see that, well, the court said, as I said before, so that means it all applies to both crimes. These were less than ideal instructions, wouldn't the
What I would say is that, one, the instructions were not erroneous, but with the benefit of hindsight, I think all of us reading all the briefs that have been submitted could probably would probably draft them differently and more cleanly in certain spots. But that's not to say that I think that they were erroneous in this particular case.
The problem I have with the instructions, counsel, and maybe your argument can address this, is that, you know, we're all lawyers and judges sitting here parsing through the instructions and really trying to ascertain what the jury made of all of this. I mean, sometimes there are lawyers on a jury, but usually they're not. Are we expecting jurors to do the job of a lawyer or a judge parsing through these instructions?
I think as someone who's tried jury trials, our instructions tend to be, and anybody who sat through or conducted a jury trial would know, they can be tedious. It's a tedious part of a trial. Jurors are tired. Attorneys are tired. Even judges get tired. And they can be long. And so from I think your point, I think in appropriate cases, yes, one instruction on self-defense or accident would be appropriate. If the defense goes to an element that's common to all of the greater charge and then any lesser charges, as it would be the case here where we're talking about a specific kind of risk, that is the unreasonable substantial risk of death or great bodily harm. On the other hand, we'll have jury trials where we have a first-degree intentional charge, maybe a second-degree intentional charge, and then a first-degree reckless charge. Now we're mixing up things in the sense that self-defense in one case is an affirmative defense with the intent crimes, but it's a negative defense with respect to recklessness. So one would need to use 800, which is geared towards the intent crimes, and 801, which is geared towards reckless and negligent crimes. So it would depend on the circumstances. There are times when one could probably function and serve its purpose, and there are times when you may need to do multiple. I would say this, I believe based on my review of the record that the jurors were provided with a set of the instructions. I think at one point they asked the court a question about the instructions. So as someone who's tried cases, jurors have had, in the cases I've tried, have asked questions about instructions on occasion. And courts, when it's appropriate, will provide appropriate clarification on what certain terms of words mean.
Well, here the jury was instructed to first consider first-degree reckless homicide, and there's a set of instructions that apply to that. And then if they found the defendant not guilty, they're to move on to second-degree reckless homicide. If they find the defendant not guilty, then they move on to the negligence charge. So wouldn't you expect the jury at that point to just be reading from homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon on, so that they're not going back to look at the instructions that applied to and followed the other two charges that they had ruled out?
In this case, the judge told them up front that the self-defense instruction applies to all three charges, and then when they hit the point of negligent homicide and the judge restated self-defense, he said, as I previously indicated, as I previously told you. So this is a case where the judge directed them back to that.
Except that he also had a full separate instruction for accident and for self-defense following the negligent handling of a dangerous weapon charge. So I'm not sure if I'm a juror, whether I'm a lawyer or not, I'd go back and read the prior instructions, because why include those following the negligence charge if I meant as the judge to have the jury instead read a repetitive but not quite the same instruction for the other charge?
Because there is a slight difference between recklessness and negligence, but the difference doesn't relate to the risk itself of the harm that's created by the defendant's conduct. It relates to the defendant's state of awareness. Was Joseph actually aware that his conduct was creating an unreasonable and substantial risk versus should he have been aware of the risk? But what's important, across the board in this case, the state had to affirmatively prove that Joseph's conduct was creating an unreasonable and substantial risk. That burden was always placed squarely on the state. And because it had an affirmative obligation to prove it, by necessity, it negated the defenses of self-defense and homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon.
So would you expect then the jury to presume that the omission of the burden of proof from the self-defense instruction that followed the negligence charge, was the jury supposed to presume that, oops, the judge must have made a mistake, he doesn't have the burden of proof in here?
No, because the jury, there is burden of proof permeates it, and what the only thing that the, if one goes back prior to State versus Austin, Court of Appeals decision, that jury instruction did not include the language that's in dispute today. The Instructions Committee felt at the time, prior to Austin, that by proving affirmatively that the risk exists, it had negated any suggestion that there, it had negated the defense that was being proffered. It was only as a result of Austin that that language got inserted into the standard instruction on 801.
Mr. Lauderocket, with respect to self-defense, that's not a defense that negates one of the elements of the substantive offense, though, right? It says, yes, that happened, and I would otherwise be guilty, but I was privileged to do this. Yeah?
No, I think the way the language reads, and what the jury was told, if the defendant was acting lawfully in self-defense, his conduct did not create an unreasonable risk to another. And that I think is consistent with case law on the difference between affirmative defenses and an affirmative defense, which is what self-defense is in an intentional case, and a negative defense, which is what self-defense is in a case involving recklessness or negligence. So it's
all right. I just want to narrow you down to the actual language that you're referring to. So in the self-defense instruction, are you referring to the third element that says the defendant's beliefs were reasonable about the actual or imminent unlawful interference with the defendant's person, and so on? Is that reasonableness language there that negates the unreasonable risk of death or great bodily harm in the substantive analysis? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. So is there any necessity at all for a self-defense instruction when you're dealing with negligent homicide?
I think in a way, whether we're talking about accident or self-defense in these cases, to me it's like a theory of defense instruction. And I think it's very appropriate for defendants to have that benefit, to be told by a judge that in this case, Joseph claims that he acted in self-defense. Joseph claims that what happened here was an accident. I think from a purely legal standpoint, I think one could make the pitch, and one looking at the comments to the jury instructions and historical comments about negative defenses could make that argument. I think it's appropriate to tell a jury, and very reasonable for a judge to be able to say, yes, this is a valid legal principle. Self-defense is a valid legal principle. It applies in this case. Accident is a valid legal principle. And when something's an accident, it negates an element of the offense. So that's part of making the job of jurors more understandable. We all, I think, appreciate that we ask a lot of jurors. And so I don't have a problem with the idea of providing those instructions and that guidance in a case. And in this case, I think what's important is that that burden always remained on the state to prove each and every element of the offense. That is, and most importantly, that Joseph created a risk. And by proving his creation of a risk that was unreasonable and substantial, and not just any risk of death or harm, but any harm, but death, a risk of death or great bodily harm, it necessarily disproved self-defense. In this case, and by the way, again, it goes back to my point that the risk is the same across all three crimes that were at issue in this case. If we were dealing with an intentional homicide, it would be different. And then, yes, it would be more important to make sure that the instructions on crimes involving intent, including defense instructions, are properly worded, and that there may be circumstances where that language is going to be different as you move down the spectrum or the list of lesser included offenses. There's a question asked in this case, what about self-defense? Should it have been given in this particular case? I think in State versus Watkins, this court recognized that certainly in appropriate cases, although Watkins is an intentional crime case, but that accident and self-defense may be compatible with one another. It would depend on the circumstances. For example, one may threaten deadly force in order to prevent an unlawful interference, but one can only use deadly force or force if it's necessary to prevent death or imminent harm when there's that imminent risk of death or great bodily harm to oneself. In this case, I would note that the circuit court, in reviewing the claims about the post-conviction motions, the circuit court went through the record and actually noted, in hindsight, I probably shouldn't have given the self-defense instruction. And the court went through very carefully and laid out the evidence in the record, primarily evidence from Joseph's own testimony that undermined the claim that he was fearing, this imminent harm, and that it was necessary to prevent it.
Yeah, I thought it was a difficult defense as I went through and read everything, because he could have walked out of the bedroom. He wasn't in a corner. He wasn't, you know, even though his brother obviously was very rough, I don't know, those of us that raise boys know they can be rough with one another, not to this extent generally, but still, he could have left the room. And, you know, I was just surprised at the instruction, and then I became concerned, well, maybe it was the court's error to give that instruction, because surely I don't think anybody was able to prove from what occurred that he meant to kill his brother or he, you know. So I was just concerned about that interplay as I read it. Why shouldn't I have been?
And I think Joseph's attorney in closing statement made only a passing reference to self-defense, something to the effect, the judge has told you about self-defense, but what really happened here was an accident.
Right.
And for that reason, that's one of the reasons we argue with respect to the ineffective claim, that at least with respect to self-defense, that he wasn't prejudiced by that Joseph in this particular case, based on the facts and the record, based on the fact that he probably wasn't entitled to self-defense, that there was no prejudice to him in this case. But certainly, you know, it's, again, judges oftentimes have to make some decisions, and I think, and I'm certainly not faulting the circuit court in this case, because they're sometimes close calls as to whether or not Someone has presented enough evidence, and I think judges, and sometimes to my consternation, but I think they're correct, would rather err on the side of being protective and making sure the defense is provided than having their decision questioned in hindsight.
Yeah, and he may have seen the evidence or thought the jury might see the evidence a little bit differently, I suppose.
And I do note in the facts in this case, there is some dispute between Joseph, or disagreement between Joseph's mother's testimony about, and Joseph about whether Joseph left the room after either his mom or his brother said, "Are we done?" and left and returned, or whether it was at that moment when he was released, he got up and picked up the knife. I don't think that ultimately matters to the analysis here, but I do note that there is some disagreement between the witnesses and the people who testified, and frankly, the disagreement is understandable because of the stress of the situation and so on. In this case, again, the state would ask this court to find that there was sufficient evidence supporting the jury's verdict. That's an important decision because obviously if there wasn't, then even if it decides there was error that requires a retrial, there couldn't be a retrial if there was insufficient evidence. It asks that the court find on this record that the record conclusively demonstrated that trial counsel was not deficient, that he was not ineffective with respect to the jury instructions, that the instructions in this case, because they always here place that burden squarely on the state repeatedly to prove each element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt, did not unconstitutionally mislead the jury in a manner that violated due process. And this is also not a case in which I think an extraordinary case requiring discretionary reversal in the interest of justice. If the court looks at this case and as it's writing decisions, as the state indicated in its brief, and I think the Court of Appeals, it addressed Austin and said Austin, which is a prior Court of Appeals decision involving crimes involving reckless conduct, the Court of Appeals said this case doesn't involve, it's not quite, doesn't square with Austin. Austin does not apply, and it distinguished Austin. If this court, though, decides to address Austin, I would ask that the court consider limiting some of the language in Austin that resulted in that addition of that paragraph to 801 that's at issue here. It doesn't mean, of course, that the jury instructions committee might not decide we should keep that language we added post-Austin, but I think as a matter of law, when the state has affirmatively proved the elements of a reckless or negligent crime, specifically the risk element, it seems duplicative, redundant to tell the state it has to disprove an element that it's already required to affirmatively prove.
I'm a little surprised at the emphasis that you've given throughout your argument and just now on how you distinguish Austin and the affirmative defense you see in Austin. It seems a far simpler way to distinguish Austin to say in Austin there never was a correct self-defense instruction given, and here there was.
Certainly, the court could decide that, but I guess purely from principles of substantive criminal law, again, it's a negative defense, and if the state proved the risk affirmatively, then it has necessarily disproved the defense of self-defense. But yes, this court could do what the Court of Appeals did and say, and and say that Austin, we don't need to deal with Austin because in this case, the jury was given a complete instruction on self-defense and a complete instruction on accident. Thank you very much.
Thank you. A couple points. My client was choked to the point of not being able to breathe, and he was kicked in the stomach by his brother, who was wearing boots, to the point that he doubled over. He reacted and he picked up the knife. He did not create an unreasonable or substantial risk of great bodily harm or death under the circumstances.
Didn't he pick up the knife before he got kicked? And wasn't the kick something that made him double over?
He was kicked a second time when he had the knife.
Okay, thank you.
He was choked. He had been kicked by his brother. And that was the point where he picked up the knife.
Counsel, I understand your assertion. But if that's true, could the jury have found him guilty of homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon? Right? I mean, don't the terms of the substantive offense require the jury to find that what he did was not reasonable?
No. Under the circumstances here, the jury was given instructions about accident and self-defense that were not sufficient. When you look at the instruction on accident that they were actually given, it says if these essentially elements are fulfilled, he's not guilty of the crime. And so it essentially short-circuits their analysis on the actual charge relating to the unreasonable and substantial risk.
So with either the self-defense or the accident instructions, that's not the end of their consideration, right? They don't just focus on that to the exclusion of all else. They still have to look at the instructions for the substantive offense of homicide by negligent handling, right?
Well, I think the confusion, and the jury can't really know beyond what's there on the page and what they've been instructed, is that the accident defense, as it's laid out, doesn't properly instruct them on the defense of accident.
Let's say that's true, right? So there's a deficiency there, and if that's all they looked at, they would be operating under a misapprehension of what the law requires. But that's not all they looked at. They looked at the substantive offense too, right? And there they find that they cannot convict him unless he was criminally negligent, right?
I think the way that the accident instruction was laid out, it creates a confusion when it says, if this is satisfied, he's not guilty of the offense. And they're saying, when they look at that instruction, which was not correct,
right,
I think it's short-circuiting the other process relating to the elements of the actual charge.
So you think that the jury, having read through the accident instruction, finding it was not satisfied, stopped there and said he's guilty, without going to the instructions for the substantive offense and reading through that?
I think there's a significant possibility that happened. Furthermore, on the self-defense issue, in looking at the jury instructions as it's set forth in 801, the part that was missing from this charge of homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon, the instruction says, for all offenses involving criminal recklessness or criminal negligence, add the following to the definition of the recklessness or negligence element. And then it goes on to state the several sentences relating to, you should consider the evidence relating to self-defense in deciding whether the defendant's conduct created an unreasonable risk to another. It goes on, explains that the burden is on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act lawfully in self-defense. And you must be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt from all the evidence in the case that the risk was unreasonable. None of that was included on this charge of homicide by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon. None of that was included. It needed to have been included. Therefore, the jury misapplied the law of self-defense.
Counsel, how were we to conclude? I mean, if I understand your argument correctly, you're saying the jury was so attentive to the instructions that they noticed that the burden of proof was omitted from the self-defense instruction and the phrase unreasonable and substantial was omitted from the accident instruction. They looked at it that carefully that they noticed those omissions, but then they completely ignored the substantive instruction on negligent homicide. How are we supposed to square that?
May I answer, Your Honor?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that the issue is that they didn't know what was not there. Essentially, that language in the self-defense instruction, leaving out unreasonable substantial, they weren't given that information. They weren't given that in the instruction. They don't know what's there, and they're just going off what's on the page. And so I think there was a lot of confusion, and we can't trust what they were able to conclude in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much for interesting argument, which has got to be a very sad, sad case that we have before us for all involved. We will take a brief recess now so that other attorneys can come in and for the next case. And I think we have some students coming. We are adjourned.